I am delighted that you're here tonight, and I hope you've got your Bible with you, and encourage you to get it and turn to Genesis chapter 39. In fact, you might back up two chapters for a beginning point in chapter 37, and we'll be there in just a moment. As you see on the screen before you, tomorrow night will be our final lesson, and our study is going to be taken from the 10th chapter of the book of Romans. And our question under consideration will be, who is to blame? If you lose your soul in the day of judgment, who can you blame? Can you point your finger at God and say, God, it's because you made it too hard, too difficult, and out of my reach? Or is it that you can only blame yourself? That'll be our study on tomorrow's night's, on Friday evening. And I encourage you to come and be a part of that, and that'll wind our studies up. But I want you to turn with me in your Bible to Genesis chapter 37. And here we're introduced to Joseph as the favored son of Jacob. In chapter 37 and in verse 3, we see that now Israel loved Joseph more than all his children. And that's how we're introduced to Joseph. Well, we read a little bit further and we see that his brothers envied him. Verse 11 tells us they were quite envious of him. And verse 18 says they wanted to kill him. They were not able to do so because of one of the brothers stopping them. But I want you to notice at verse 27 that they finally decided that they would sell him to the Ishmaelites for 20 shekels of silver. And those Ishmaelites took him down to Egypt. Drop down to the very end of the chapter, verse 36. The Midianites had sold him in Egypt to Potiphar, an officer of Pharaoh and the captain of the guard. So his brother sold him to the Midianites. The Midianites sold him now to Potiphar in Egypt. And now he's in the possession of Potiphar down in Egypt, according to the text. Well, let's jump over to chapter 39, beginning at verse 1. And there we see in verses 1 to 6 that he rose in power and he brought prosperity and blessings to Potiphar's house. So beginning at verse 1, Joseph, when he'd been taken down to Egypt, and Potiphar, an officer of the captain of the guard, an Egyptian, bought him from the Ishmaelites who had taken him down there. And the Lord was with Joseph, and he was a successful man. And he was in the house of his master the Egyptian, and his master saw that the Lord was with him. And the Lord made all that he did to prosper in his hand. So Joseph found favor in his sight and served him. And he made him overseer of his house and all that he put in his hand. And was over all that he put in his hand. And so it was that from time to time that he made him overseer of his house and all that he had. And the Lord blessed the Egyptian's house for Joseph's sake. And the blessing of the Lord was on all that he had in the house and in the field. So he left all that he had in Joseph's hand and did not know what he had except the bread which he ate. And Joseph was handsome in form and in appearance. And so what we see is when he got to Potiphar's household, the Lord blessed Potiphar because of Joseph. All that he had in his hand he made to prosper. So that Potiphar began to entrust Joseph with everything that he owned and put him in great power and position. Now, beginning at verse 7 of that same context, we see that Potiphar's wife tried to seduce him. And so I want to spend a little time tonight talking about that very text, beginning at verse 7 through the end of the chapter. And let's talk for a little while about the seduction of Joseph. And for the study tonight, I want you to get your Bible open if you haven't already. And we're going to read Genesis 39, beginning at verse 7 through the end of the chapter. And then we're going to come back and learn some things from the things that we just read. So read with me, if you will, beginning at verse 7. That it came to pass, after these things, that the master's wife cast longing eyes on Joseph and said, lie with me. But he refused. And he said to his master's wife, look, my master does not know what is with me in the house. And he has committed all that he has into my hand. And there is no one greater in the house than I, nor has he kept back anything from me but you, because you are his wife. How can I do this great wickedness and sin against God? And so it was that as she spoke to Joseph day by day, that he did not heed her to lie with her or to be with her. But it happened about this time that Joseph went into the house to do his work, that none of the men of the house was inside. And she caught him by the garment, saying, lie with me. But he left his garment in her hand and fled and ran outside. And so it was that when she saw that he left his garment in her hand, he fled out and fled outside, that she called to the men of her house and spoke to them, saying, see, he has brought into us a Hebrew to mock us, and he came in to me to lie with me, and I cried out with a loud voice. And it happened that when he heard that I lifted up my voice and cried out, that he left his garment with me and fled and went outside. So she kept his garment with her until her master came home. And she spoke to him with these words like these, saying, "The Hebrew servant whom you have brought to us came in to me to mock me. And so it happened as I lifted my voice and I cried out that he left his garment with me and fled outside." And so it was, and his master heard these words with his wife, which his wife spoke to him, saying, "Your master did to me according to this manner, that his anger was aroused." Then Joseph's master took him and put him into the prison, a place where the king's prisoners were confined, and that he was there in the prison. But the Lord was with Joseph and showed him mercy, gave him power, or gave him favor in the sight of the keeper of the prison. And the keeper of the prison committed to Joseph's hand all the prisoners that were in the prison. And whatever they did there, it was his doing. And the keeper of the prison did not look into anything that was under Joseph's hand, because the Lord was with him. And whatever he did, the Lord made it prosper. Now that's the story of the seduction of Joseph. And I want you to notice that there were three things that immediately come to our attention upon the reading of the story of the seduction of Joseph. First of all, I want you to notice that she seduced him. That's obvious from the reading of our text. Secondly, he resisted her. That's also obvious in the reading of our text. Thirdly, there was the results that followed because of that. That may not be as immediately noticed as the first two. So I want us to consider three things in our study tonight as we talk about the seduction of Joseph. And I want to spend a little time describing before you the fact that the temptation was strong. And I want you to see that the temptation was really strong. And I want to paint before you a picture that it wasn't just a mere temptation where Joseph came in contact with a woman who provided an opportunity for him to sin, and he easily resisted that. But I want to picture before you that he had a very, very strong temptation. How so? Well, it was strong when I consider the fact of his youth. When I consider how young that he really was. When I consider the fact that he was somewhere in the age of 18 to 28 years of age. How do I know that? You remember we were introduced to him as a 17-year-old man in chapter 37. At the end of our reading, he went to prison. Here in the passages you have before you in chapter 41, verse 46 and verse 1, that when he was released from prison, he was 30 years old and he had been there for 2 years. Well, that brings him back to about 28, no older than 28. So he was somewhere at the time when all of this was taking place, somewhere between the ages of 18 and 28. He was a young man. He was not so young that this would not have been an impressionable thing upon him. Nor was he so old that this would not have bothered him. But he is at an age when we would read in the Bible that there are youthful lusts that are strong. Paul would warn Timothy, flee youthful lust. There are some temptations that are stronger in one's youth. And perhaps this is one. This would have been a time of his life when maybe it was at its strongest. Paul describes in 1 Corinthians 7 and in verse 9, it is better to marry than to burn with desire. Oh, you think about it, when he was a man of 18, 20, or 21, or 22, or no later than 28 years of age. And here comes along a young woman that says, come lie with me. Oh, the temptation was strong. And here's a very practical thing I learned from that. We quite often sell our young people short. As if young people in general are interested in worldly things and they'll do worldly things. Here is an example of a young man who had faith, who had courage, and he had principle about him and purity about him. Just like some of our young people today. We have young people among us that have the same kind of faith we who are older have. They say have the same kind of purity that we have. They have the same kind of principle that we have. Joseph is just one example of that. But here's another thing I want you to consider with me. His temptation was strong when I consider the fact that it was she that solicited him, not he seducing her. I want you to think about that for a moment. That it was she that was soliciting him. It was her that came along and said, come lie with me, she said. She was the one begging him, not he begging her. But I want you to add to that this fact. I want you to notice with me at verse 7. The text says she cast longing eyes at him. Have you thought about what that means? The New American Standard says she looked with desire at Joseph. You think about his age now.
And you think about someone saying, come lie with me, but she says it with those eyes. Another translation, the Living Bible paraphrase says, she began making eyes at Joseph. Proverbs 6:25 says she can say more with her eyes than she can say with her lips. By the way, chapters 5, 6, and 7, let's footnote for a moment. Proverbs chapters 5, chapter 6, chapter 7 are three chapters that go together as a unit of chapters that warn about the harlot, the strange woman. Not only saying don't commit fornication with her, but here's the things and the tools that she will use to break you down so that you yield to the temptation. And he says in verse 25, nor let her allure you with her eyelids. She can catch those eyes and she can say more with the look of her eyes than she can say with 1,000 words. She began making eyes at Joseph. Or it may mean, as some have suggested, that she set her eye as a target upon him. I think the former is the case, but maybe this is the case. That is, some suggest that what that means when she casts longing eyes, that she set her eye on him, that he's my target. I'm going to break him down. I will seduce him. He will be the one I will conquer. Whatever the case, the temptation was strong. Oh, the temptation was strong. The temptation was strong when I consider the fact that she told him how far she was willing to go. Remember what she said? Are you reading with me? Still open to Genesis 39. At verse 7, she said, come lie with me. She told him how far she was willing to go. She's not toying and flirting only to turn out to be a tease. Sometimes someone might do that. They might toy and they might cast those flirting eyes and they might leave the impression how far they're willing to go, but when it looks like he's going that far, oh no, I'm not interested in that. That's not what she's doing. She says, here's how far I'm willing to go. She said, come lie with me. And I want to tell you, there would be very few young men, if any, in Egypt that could have resisted that kind of temptation. Consider how young he was. Consider she was the one coming on to him. And consider the fact that she was casting longing eyes and she said, here's how far I'm willing to go with you. Oh, the temptation was strong. But I want you to consider something else. The temptation was strong when I consider the repetition of that. When I consider the repetition of her temptation. Resistance at first is not all that hard. Let me give you an example of that. Remember Eve? Remember when Satan came in the form of a serpent and he tempted her and she resisted at first? Remember, she said, no, I can't do that. But she finally yielded to the temptation. Resistance at first isn't all that hard. Samson's another case of that. Remember when Delilah would tempt him, he resisted. And when she tempted him again, he resisted. But he finally caved to the pressure. Resistance at first is not all that hard. And perhaps the first time that Potiphar's wife said, come lie with me, it would have been easy to say, no, I'm not that kind of man. But I want you to consider with me, the text says that this continued on a daily basis. Look at verse 10 with me, if you will. And so it was that as she spoke to Joseph, are you reading now? Day by day, that he did not heed her. Consider how young he was. She's making eyes at him. She says, here's how far I'm willing to go. And she says this today. She says it the next day. And she says it the next day. And the next day. And the temptation is getting stronger all the time. Here's how far I'm willing to go. Let's turn to Proverbs chapter 6. You remember I told you those three chapters go together? And I want to talk to you from Satan's point of view as he tempts you through those avenues. That in Proverbs the 6th chapter and in verse 26. That from Satan's vantage point, what he's trying to do is he's trying to break you down. He's trying to destroy you. Look at Proverbs 6 and in verse 26. For by means of a harlot, a man is reduced to a crust of bread. And an adulteress will prey upon his precious life. You just think of taking a piece of toast and you just begin to crumble it. Just that easy. Satan is designing to break you down. She's trying to wear him down. Perhaps she expects him to say no at first. Maybe she expects him to say no again. And maybe she expects him to say no again. But eventually, I keep making these eyes, and eventually he's going to cave to the pressure like Samson did. Oh, the temptation was strong. But I want you to consider something else. When we talk about the temptation was strong, I want you to consider the fact of the convenient opportunity that he had.
Temptation is strongest when there is a convenient opportunity.
Now, the fact that one could easily get caught serves as a deterrent, doesn't it? Now, if you were tempted to steal, for example, let's illustrate it with stealing. If you were tempted to steal and someone left money on this table in the presence of us all, that's kind of a deterrent, the fact that everybody's watching, isn't it? And if you're tempted to steal something and you look around and there's cameras all around that may catch me and I will be the one who is identified, that serves as a deterrent to my sin. But if you begin to look around and you think I may not get caught, and the temptation is strong, then it becomes even stronger. Consider this fact in verse 11.
What made this a convenient opportunity? We'll look in Genesis chapter 39 and in verse 11. But it happened about this time that Joseph went into the house to do his work, and none of the men of the house was inside. Nobody is around. The master is gone. We won't get caught.
And perhaps she's looking for the right opportunity. The master is gone. Everybody else is out of the house. Joseph comes through the house and she catches him and she says, come lie with me. Not in front of everybody. No one else is around. No one else is around in the house. Let's go to Proverbs chapter 7, if you will.
Remember, I remind you again, chapters 5, 6, and 7 go together as a unit. Go back to Proverbs chapter 7. And I want to suggest to you that being alone without anybody else around, we may not get caught, is an enticing circumstance that you may not realize how enticing it is to you in that circumstance. And so let's begin in Proverbs 7 in verse 19. Remember, this is a harlot. She comes out to the young man and she meets him. According to verse 15, I came out diligently to seek your face and I found you. You're the only guy for me. I wouldn't do this with anybody else, she says. But look at verse 19 beginning. For my husband is not at home.
Oh, his interest is perked. He's gone on a long journey. A long journey. He's not gone to the store. He's gone on a long journey. His interest is piqued even more. He's taken a bag of money with him. How do you know he's going to be gone for a long time? He took a bag of money with him. He took his traveler's checks with him. Look at verse 20. He'll come home on an appointed day. Husband said he'd be gone. He's going to be gone for 2 weeks. Took his traveler's checks with him. He's not coming back for a long time. We won't get caught. We won't get caught. No one will ever know. And what I'm telling you is the temptation was strong. Here's something I learned from that, friend. And that is, there's a danger of being alone when no one else is around. You want to talk about the seduction of Joseph? The temptation was strong when you consider the fact no one else was around. When there's nobody around in that parked car with you, except you and the other person, or in that room, or in that apartment, or that house, or that living room, wherever it may be, there's no one else around, the temptation becomes stronger than you ever believed it would be. Oh, the temptation was strong. What made it strong? You consider how young he was. He was a young man, 18 to 28 years of age. And you consider the fact that she was the one that was soliciting him. Here's what I want to do. Furthermore, she told him how far she was willing to go. She cast longing eyes. She's making eyes at him. And she did it again and again and again. And she wouldn't let up. And then you consider, finally, there's a convenient opportunity. The master's not at home and no one else is around. Oh, the temptation was strong. But equal to that, I want to suggest to you tonight that the resistance was firm. The temptation was strong, but the resistance was firm. What did Joseph do? Well, let's consider this. I want you to notice that he resisted with words. He didn't just act. He said some things. In fact, there were five things he said. First of all, in resisting with words, he said, no, I'm not going to do it. Look at verse 8. Look at Genesis 39 and in verse 8. Verse 8 says, but he, are you reading with me? You might underline. He refused. What does that mean? It means he said, no, I'm not going to do it. Verse 10. So it was that as she spoke to Joseph day by day that he did not heed her. What does that tell you? I tell you, he resisted by saying, no, I'm not going to do that. Those of you who are old enough to remember, when Nancy Reagan was first lady, she has led a campaign that said, just say no to drugs. And she was heavily criticized for that, as you remember, in those days, because that doesn't work.
You can't just say no to drugs. They've got to do more than that. Well, I've often wondered, what was wrong with saying no to drugs and saying no to any sin? And that's exactly what Joseph is doing. He's saying no to sin. I'm not going to do that. But that's not all he did. That's not all he said. Here's something else he said. He spoke to her about the trust that someone had in him. Look at verse 8. But he refused, and he said to his master's wife, "Look, my master does not know what is with me in the house, and has committed all that he has into my hand."
What are you saying, Joseph? I'm saying I do not want to betray the trust that your husband, my master, has in me. Someone trusts me to do the right thing, and that includes treating you proper. Your husband trusts me. I'm not going to betray that trust.
I'll tell you, young folks, your parents trust you to conduct yourself properly when you're on a date. They trust you. Don't betray that trust. Husbands, your wife trusts you to conduct yourself properly when you're around other people. Wives, your husband trusts you. Don't betray the trust.
He said, no, I'm not going to do it. Somebody trust me. That's not all he said. Here's the third thing he said. He recalled the sacredness of marriage.
Look at verse 9. There's no one greater than I in the house, and he has not kept back anything from me but you, because you are his wife.
You're a married woman. There's the sacredness of marriage. No, we're not going to do this. It's not right, first of all. But your master trusts me is one of the reasons we won't do that. But there's another reason is because you're a married woman. And there's something about the sacredness of marriage that I do not want to betray. I don't want to break that trust. But that's not all he said. Here's the fourth thing. He called it wickedness or evil. It's immoral.
Look at verse 9. He asked her, "How can I do this great wickedness?" What you're asking me to do is wicked. It's evil. It's immoral. But that's not all he said. The fifth thing he said was, at the end of verse 9, he called it a sin against God. It's a sin against God. It is not just that you're a married woman. It is not just that we'd be breaking the marriage vows. It is not just that I'd be breaking up a marriage, perhaps. It's not merely that you would be untrue and unfaithful to your husband. It is the fact that we would be sinning against God. I think we forget about that fact sometimes. And here's what I mean by that. Someone commits adultery.
Here's a man commits adultery against his wife, or wife against her husband.
And we get up in arms, and rightly so, that he has done his wife wrong. How could he do that to her? How could he do that? Good question, isn't it? That's not all he did. He sinned against God. There's where the problem is. And notice what he said.
He said five things about this sin to her. He said, no, I'm not going to do it. He spoke of trust. He recalled the sacredness of marriage. He called it wickedness. And he says it's a sin against God. But that's not all that he did.
The resistance was firm because he resisted with deeds. There were two things I want you to notice about that. First of all, he refused to be with her, verse 10. What do we mean by that? Well, look at verse 10. Verse 10, have you caught at the end of the verse? We often emphasize in reading the text that he refused, and he took his garment and he fled and he ran outside. I'll come to that in a moment. And that he refused to heed her, verse 10. But notice at the end of verse 10, that as she spoke to Joseph day by day, that he did not heed her to lie with her. Now here's your word. You might underline, or to be with her. Or to be with her is different from lying with her.
He refused, the text says, to commit fornication, but more than that, he refused even to be with her.
What does that mean?
The New International translates, or to even be with her. The Living Bible says to keep out of her way as much as possible. You know what that's saying? That he saw a temptation here and he thought, I don't want to commit fornication with her, and since I don't want to be tempted anymore, I'm going to refuse any association with her. I'm going to avoid her as much as possible. He understood the principle that there is a danger in association.
He didn't decide, you know what, I want to stick around a little bit. I kind of like her making those eyes at me. I think I'll stick around a little bit and see if she's really serious about how far she's going to go.
There's danger in association. He understands that if you hang around, that could easily lead to greater temptation. Maybe the temptation becomes so great he can't resist.
Let's go to the book of Proverbs again in chapter 5. I said those three chapters go together. Here is the warning to the young man how to avoid the entrapment of a harlot. And notice in verse 8 he says, remove your way far from her. Don't only remove your way from her, but remove your way far from her. And do not go near the door of her house. You avoid that association.
I've known of people who have had temptations at work with somebody they worked with. And so what do? They keep that close association. Rather than severing that relationship, rather than avoiding that relationship, they still nourish that and they feed that relationship, and the temptation becomes stronger and they have more problems again.
He resisted with deeds.
He refused to even be with her, the text says, but that's not all that he did. He fled and he ran outside. Let's go to verse 12.
Perhaps this is the part of the story we all remember. But at verse 12 says that she caught him by the garment, saying, lie with me. And he left the garment in her hand and he fled and he ran outside. I'm here to tell you that was done literally. He literally fled, he ran, and he went outside.
He removed himself from the temptation. He took off and he ran. His actions showed that his words were real. When he was saying no, he meant no. When he said, I don't want to betray the trust, he doesn't want to betray the trust. When he said, this is wickedness and sin against God, he really believed it was wickedness and sin against God. That's what that meant.
And I want to suggest to you that you may have to leave. Listen to me carefully, young folks.
That may mean that there's a time when you're on a date that you may have to literally get out of the car and you may have to run somewhere and call for somebody to come and get you. You may have to leave the apartment. You may have to leave the house. You may just have to bolt out somewhere lest something happen of which you will be ashamed. You may have to call somebody to come and get you. That would be far better to be embarrassed
by calling someone to come and get you because you're trying to avoid sin than to come up embarrassed because you have a child out of wedlock. And what he did was he fled and he ran outside, the text said.
But that's not all. The temptation was strong, but the resistance was firm. What do you mean it was firm? He resisted with words. He resisted with deeds. But I want to suggest to you, verse 8 and verse 12 says he resisted promptly.
When verse 8 says he refused, and in verse 12 says he fled and he ran outside, that tells me three or four things. First of all, that tells me that it was without the slightest hesitation. He did it without dallying with the temptation to see how far it may go. No waiting to see if she's real in what she says. He resisted promptly. None of this thinking, well, you know, really, I shouldn't do that.
I just don't think I should. But he said, no, I'm not going to do it. And he fled and he ran outside. But I want to suggest to you that he resisted firmly in verses 8 through 10. There was no wavering.
There was no indecision. There was no pushing aside something he really wanted to secretly do. He said no, and he meant no. And his action proved that. Now, we all recognize there are times when you might be invited to do something, and you might say no, but you say it in a way that says
that I'm not real 100% sure about that. If you ask me again, I might change my mind and say yes. We've all done that. Somebody invites you to go with them, go to eat with them, go to their house, and you say, well, no, I really shouldn't. And then they say, well, come on and let's go. Well, I guess all, not, and you're beginning to cave, aren't you? But you can say no where they won't invite you again. If you invited me to come to your house and I said, no, I don't want to go, you probably wouldn't invite me again, would you?
You can say no with such affirmation that they might not invite you again. Say, come lie with me.
Oh, his resistance was firm. What do we mean by that? He resisted with words. Remember the five things he said? He said, no. No, I can't do that.
My master, trust me. You're a married woman. This would be wickedness and sin against God.
He resisted with deeds by refusing to even associate with her. And then he ran outside. And he did so promptly and he did so firmly. But finally, the temptation was strong. The resistance was firm. But thirdly, the results were clear. And what I want to suggest to you is that when Joseph finally got out on the other side, he fled and he ran outside. Verse 12 says, when he gets on the outside, Joseph now can look back and see three things clearer than he's ever seen them before. Now, Joseph may have seen these things, but not with the clarity he sees them now. He can look back and see things with greater clarity than he's ever seen before. What is he seeing? First of all, he sees the difference between love and lust. He may have understood that before, but he certainly understands it now. There's a big difference between love and lust. This woman lusted for Joseph, but she didn't love him. She didn't love him at all. Let me give you some evidence of that. Do you remember her lie and her effort to destroy him? Let's notice beginning about verse 14. You remember when he fled and he ran outside and she held the garment in his hand? Now she's got something, she's going to do something with it. So what does she do? She calls for the men of the house. The master's not around just yet. What does she say? See, verse 14, he has brought into us a Hebrew to mock us, and he came into lie with me, and I cried out with a loud voice. Let me paraphrase that. You see this garment in my hand? That Hebrew that he brought in here to us, he tried to rape me, and if I hadn't screamed and hollered, he would have got away with it. That's what she's saying. Then what does she do? When the master comes in, she's still got the garment. And she tells him the same thing. That Hebrew you brought in, he came in to mock me. He tried to rape me. And I screamed and I cried. And if it wasn't for that, he would have got away with it. She's trying to destroy the man. She doesn't love him. She doesn't care a thing about him.
But she lusted for him. Pulpit correctly said, but indeed all illicit passion, whether gratified or balked, has a tendency sooner or later to be transformed into hate. I say amen. You stop and think about that. It's not uncommon for someone who has this great passion and love for someone. More lust than love, rather, is what I'm trying to say. And when that's not satisfied, or even if it is satisfied, quite often turns to hatred and turns to bitterness. What I want to suggest to you, young folks, is the fact that one may lust after you does not necessarily love you. Lust seeks gratification. Love cares about the person. And when you tell them, I'm a person of purity and I don't want to violate that purity. I'm a person of reverence for God. I do not want to violate God. And they have no respect for that. They don't love you. They may lust for you, but they may not love you. Joseph can now see with greater clarity. There is a big difference between love and lust. She was lusting for him, but she didn't love him. She didn't care about him. I would that all could see that before that act comes. But here's a second thing he can see. He can see what he lost. Whether he understood at the moment he was fleeing and running outside, when he gets outside, he can look back and he can see, you know what, I left some things in there. I left some things with her that I didn't bring with me. What did he leave behind? Well, obviously, the most obvious is his coat. Not of great value in the story, is it? But he did leave his coat behind, didn't he? And he had to take notice of the fact that when he got outside, he looks back and thinks, I left my coat with her. But that's not all he left. I'll tell you something else he left in there. He left his job. Verse 20. Remember, he was working for Potiphar? Verse 20 says he's been put in prison. He doesn't have a job anymore. He just lost his job. That's a big deal. He lost his position. His status. But that's not all he lost. He lost his freedom. He left it inside with her. Because by her lies and what she's telling, he's now cast into prison for 2 years as an innocent man. He gets outside and he looks back and he sees he lost his standing and his approval among men. You say, how do you know that? She's lying about him, isn't she? Isn't she telling all the men of the household, the guards, he tried to rape me? Didn't she tell her master that? And then he cast in prison. And anybody who worked around who knew that the position of Joseph
had all within his hands. Where's Joseph? Well, he's cast in prison. Why? Well, they've got him on charges of rape.
It doesn't go too well, does it, in your reputation? I don't know about you. Even as an innocent man, I don't think I'd want to be charged with that, would you?
Tell you something else. And that is, you may lose some things yourself.
When you resist and you resist with firmness, you may lose some things. You may lose your boyfriend. You may lose your girlfriend. You may lose your standing among friends because you're the only one in the crowd who hadn't done this. I can't believe you're the only one. And that boyfriend may threaten he's going to dump you because you won't yield to the temptation. And you may lose him. He may be gone. The girl may be gone. Because you're the only boy around that won't do this kind of thing. But I want to tell you something else.
And finally, I want us to consider that he brought some things with him. Have you thought about that? We talk about him leaving his coat behind. Have you thought about what he brought out with him? He brought some things with him that he could have left. But because of his faithfulness and his diligence and his purity and his faith, he brought them out with him. What did he bring out? He brought his purity with him. He could have left that inside.
But he brought his purity out with him, didn't he? He's a pure man. He's godly, he's righteous and pure before God. He brought that out with him. That's worth far more than that coat. Worth a whole lot more than that job. Worth more than that freedom. Worth more than the esteem among men. Tell you something else he brought out with him.
He brought his honor with him. Proverbs 6, remember those three chapters we've been talking about go together? Talking about the man who yields to the harlot. Wounds and dishonor will he get. David said concerning his sin with Bathsheba, Psalm 51,
my sin is ever before me. He brought his honor with him. He doesn't have something hanging over his head. He doesn't have a cloud that follows him. He doesn't have guilt that's bearing down upon him.
What else did he bring? He brought his conscience with him. He's got a clear conscience now. Joseph is not setting off on the side on a stump now thinking, oh man, what have I done?
What on earth have I done? Why did I do that? I don't know what overcame me. I don't know how to explain this. I am so embarrassed. He brought his conscience with him.
I'll tell you something else. He brought his reputation among the godly. Now, there were people. Had to be. As Joseph is in prison on the charge of rape,
there had to be people that didn't. May have swallowed that. But among the godly, he has a great reputation. Evidence? We're talking about him tonight, aren't we? Aren't we? Holding as a great example? Pretty good testimony to his godliness, isn't it? Quite a public place to mention it right here in the Scriptures. And finally, I want to suggest you, beginning at verse 21 of our context,
he kept his relationship with his God. He brought that out. He could have left that in. He could have yielded and left his relationship with God, and it's gone. And what evidence do I have of that?
Well, when he's in prison, things begin to go well in the prison, so that the keeper of the prison put all that was in the prisoners into his hand. Why? Well, verse 23 says, the keeper of the prison did not look into anything under Joseph's hands because the Lord was with him. And whatever he did, the Lord made it to prosper. He still has his relationship with God. He still has his relationship with God. Now, what we've seen
is Joseph looks back and he sees three things with greater clarity than he's ever seen before. Did Joseph understand these things? I have no doubt he had. But he knows now that there's a difference in love and lust, and he sees the things I left in there. I don't have a job anymore. I don't have a coat anymore. My reputation may be shot, but I want to tell you, he brought out his purity and his conscience and his honor and his relationship with his God.
That's the seduction of Joseph. The temptation was strong. The resistance was firm. And oh, were the results clear. And we may wonder sometimes, why do we preach on subjects like this, and what good does it do? And I must admit, that when I first started preaching that I thought to myself, preaching to an audience like this where you have godly people preaching on fornication and adultery and those kinds of things, everybody knows it's wrong. Why do you do that? And I've come to learn there's value in preaching on that. There was a survey made a number of years ago among college students in the universities across the land, and I don't know what the numbers were, but there was a high percentage of the college students, university students, that committed fornication, had premarital relationships. And so there were some brethren, and I use that in quotations loosely, who decided they wanted to make a similar survey among so-called Christian schools operated by some brethren, such as David Lipscomb and Harding and Fried Hardeman and those kinds of schools. And they did. And they found that the number of those committing fornications was significantly lower. They still had problems, but significantly lower than the national average. So the next question was, why is that the case? And there were a number of reasons the students gave. Some were afraid of venereal disease. Some were afraid of pregnancy. Some said their parents had instilled this in them. Some said that Bible class teachers had really helped them. Some said the peer pressure was not as great. Number one answer. Pulpit preaching and teaching on the subject. Surprise. And so my goal is, maybe this sermon will just help one person. Maybe 10 years, maybe it's a long time. Somebody may not remember that old preacher that came. I don't remember his name, but he came from somewhere in Tennessee, Kentucky. I don't know where he's from. But he came and he preached on Joseph. I do remember that. And that prevented me from committing the sin. Our time is well spent. This will be one of the best meetings we ever had. If we just save one soul. Just one. Our time is well spent. There may be one or more present tonight who's not a Christian, who's not a child of God. Would you come believing that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of the living God? Would you repent of your sins, acknowledge your faith, and be buried in the waters of baptism for the remission of sins? It may be there's an erring child of God who needs to make correction. If you're a subject in any way, we hope and trust that you'll come. While together we stand and while we sing.